This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Left Behind by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, narrated by Richard Ferrone. This work is copyrighted 1995 by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books Incorporated. In one cataclysmic moment, millions around the globe disappear. Vehicles, suddenly unmanned, careen out of control. People are terror-stricken as loved ones vanish before their eyes. In the midst of instantaneous global chaos, those left behind must search for answers, for truth. For as devastating as the disappearances have been, the darkest days may lie ahead. And now, Left Behind.
Chapter 1. Rayford Steele's mind was on a woman he had never touched. With his fully loaded 747 on autopilot above the Atlantic en route to a 6 a.m. landing at Heathrow, Rayford had pushed from his mind thoughts of his family. Over spring break he would spend time with his wife and 12-year-old son. Their daughter would be home from college, too. But for now, with his first officer dozing, Rayford imagined Hattie Durham's smile and looked forward to their next meeting. Hattie was Rayford's senior flight attendant. He hadn't seen her in more than an hour. Rayford used to look forward to getting home to his wife. Irene was attractive and vivacious enough, even at 40, but lately he had found himself repelled by her obsession with religion. It was all she could talk about. God was okay with Rayford Steele. Rayford even enjoyed church occasionally. But since Irene had hooked up with a smaller congregation and was into weekly Bible studies and church every Sunday, Rayford had become uncomfortable. Hers was not a church where people gave you the benefit of the doubt, assumed the best about you, and let you be. People there had actually asked him to his face what God was doing in his life. "Blessing my socks off," had become the smiling response that seemed to satisfy them, but he found more and more excuses to be busy on Sundays. Rayford tried to tell himself it was his wife's devotion to a divine suitor that caused his mind to wander. But he knew the real reason was his own libido. Besides, Hattie Durham was drop-dead gorgeous. No one could argue that. What he enjoyed most was that she was a toucher. Nothing inappropriate, nothing showy. She simply touched his arm as she brushed past, or rested her hand gently on his shoulder when she stood behind his seat in the cockpit. It wasn't her touch alone that made Rayford enjoy her company. He could tell from her expressions, her demeanor, her eye contact, that she at least admired and respected him. Whether she was interested in anything more, he could only guess. And so he did. They had spent time together, chatting for hours over drinks or dinner, sometimes with co-workers, sometimes not. He hadn't returned so much as one brush of a finger, but his eyes had held her gaze, and he could only assume his smile had made its point. Maybe today. Maybe this morning, if her coded tap on the door didn't rouse his first officer, he would reach and cover the hand on his shoulder, in a friendly way he hoped she would recognize as a step, a first from his side toward a relationship. And a first it would be. He was no prude, but Rayford had never been unfaithful to Irene. He'd had plenty of opportunities. He had long felt guilty about a private necking session he enjoyed at a company Christmas party more than 12 years before. Irene had stayed home uncomfortably past her 9th month carrying their surprise tag-along son, Ray Jr. Though under the influence, Rayford had known enough to leave the party early. It was clear Irene noticed he was slightly drunk, but she couldn't have suspected anything else, not from her straight-arrow captain. He was the pilot who had once consumed 2 martinis during a snowy shutdown at O'Hare and then voluntarily grounded himself when the weather cleared. He offered to pay for bringing in a relief pilot, but Pan Continental was so impressed that instead they made an example of his self-discipline and wisdom. In a couple of hours, Rayford would be the first to see hints of the sun, a teasing palette of pastels that would signal the reluctant dawn over the continent. Until then, the blackness through the window seemed miles thick. His groggy or sleeping passengers had window shades down, pillows and blankets in place. For now, the plane was a dark, humming sleep chamber for all but a few wanderers, the attendants, and one or two responders to nature's call. The question of the darkest hour before dawn, then, was whether Rayford Steele should risk a new, exciting relationship with Hattie Durham. He suppressed a smile. Was he kidding himself? Would someone with his reputation ever do anything but dream about a beautiful woman 15 years his junior? He wasn't so sure anymore. If only Irene hadn't gone off on this new kick. Would it fade, her preoccupation with the end of the world, with the love of Jesus, with the salvation of souls? Lately she had been reading everything she could get her hands on about the rapture of the church. "Can you imagine, Rafe?" she exulted. "Jesus coming back to get us before we die?" "Yeah, boy," he said, peeking over the top of his newspaper. "That would kill me." She was not amused. "If I didn't know what would happen to me," she said, "I wouldn't be glib about it." "I do know what would happen to me," he insisted. "I'd be dead, gone, fini. But you, of course, would fly right up to heaven." He hadn't meant to offend her. He was just having fun. When she turned away, he rose and pursued her. He spun her around and tried to kiss her, but she was cold. "Come on, Irene," he said. "Tell me thousands wouldn't just keel over if they saw Jesus coming back for all the good people." She had pulled away in tears. "I've told you and told you. Saved people aren't good people. They're just forgiven." "Yeah, I know," he said, feeling rejected and vulnerable in his own living room. He returned to his chair and his paper. "If it makes you feel any better, I'm happy for you that you can be so cocksure." "I only believe what the Bible says," Irene said. Rayford shrugged. He wanted to say, "Good for you," but he didn't want to make a bad situation worse. In a way, he had envied her confidence, but in truth, he wrote it off to her being a more emotional, more feelings-oriented person. He didn't want to articulate it, but the fact was he was brighter, yes, more intelligent. He believed in rules, systems, laws, patterns, things you could see and feel and hear and touch. If God was part of all that, okay. A higher power, a loving being, a force behind the laws of nature, fine. Let's sing about it, pray about it, feel good about our ability to be kind to others and go about our business. Rayford's greatest fear was that this religious fixation wouldn't fade like Irene's Amway days, her Tupperware phase and her aerobics spell. He could just see her ringing doorbells and asking if she could read people a verse or two. Surely she knew better than to dream of his tagging along. Irene had become a full-fledged religious fanatic, and somehow that freed Rayford to dream without guilt about Hattie Durham. Maybe he would say something, suggest something, hint at something as he and Hattie strode through Heathrow toward the cab line. Maybe earlier. Dare he assert himself even now, hours before touchdown? Next to a window in first class, a writer sat hunched over his laptop. He shut down the machine, vowing to get back to his journal later. At 30, Cameron Williams was the youngest ever senior writer for the prestigious Global Weekly. The envy of the rest of the veteran staff, he either scooped them on or was assigned to the best stories in the world. Both admirers and detractors at the magazine called him Buck because they said he was always bucking tradition and authority. Buck believed he lived a charmed life, having been eyewitness to some of the most pivotal events in history. A year and 2 months earlier, his January 1st cover story had taken him to Israel to interview Chaim Rosenzweig and had resulted in the most bizarre event he had ever experienced. The elderly Rosenzweig had been the only unanimous choice for Newsmaker of the Year in the history of Global Weekly. Its staff had customarily steered clear of anyone who would be an obvious pick as Time's Man of the Year, but Rosenzweig was an automatic. Cameron Williams had gone into the staff meeting prepared to argue for Rosenzweig and against whatever media star the others would typically champion. He was pleasantly surprised when executive editor Steve Plank opened with, "Anybody want to nominate someone stupid, such as anyone other than the Nobel Prize winner in chemistry?" The senior staff members looked at each other, shook their heads, and pretended to begin leaving. "Put the chairs on the wagon. The meeting is over," Buck said. "Steve, I'm not angling for it, but you know I know the guy, and he trusts me." "Not so fast, cowboy," a rival said, then appealed to Plank. "You letting Buck assign himself now?"
"I might," Steve said,
"and what if I do?"
"I just think this is a technical piece, a science story," Buck's detractor muttered. "I'd put the science writer on it."
"And you'd put the reader to sleep," Plank said. "Come on, you know the writer for showcase pieces comes from this group. And this is not a science piece any more than the first one Buck did on him. This has to be told so the reader gets to know the man and understands the significance of his achievement."
"Like that isn't obvious. It only changed the course of history."
"I'll make the assignment today," the executive editor said.
"Thanks for your willingness, Buck. I assume everyone else is willing as well."
Expressions of eagerness filled the room, but Buck also heard grumbled predictions that the fair-haired boy would get the nod, which he did. Such confidence from his boss and competition from his peers made him all the more determined to outdo himself with every assignment. In Israel, Buck stayed in a military compound and met with Rosenzweig in the same kibbutz on the outskirts of Haifa where he had interviewed him a year earlier. Rosenzweig was fascinating, of course, but it was his discovery or invention, no one knew quite how to categorize it, that was truly the newsmaker of the year. The humble man called himself a botanist, but he was in truth a chemical engineer who had concocted a synthetic fertilizer that caused the desert sands of Israel to bloom like a greenhouse.
"Irrigation has not been a problem for decades," the old man said. "But all that did was make the sand wet. My formula, added to the water, fertilizes the sand."
Buck was not a scientist, but he knew enough to shake his head at that simple statement. Rosenzweig's formula was fast making Israel the richest nation on earth, far more profitable than its oil-laden neighbors. Every inch of ground blossomed with flowers and grains, including produce never before conceivable in Israel. The Holy Land became an export capital, the envy of the world, with virtually zero unemployment. Everyone prospered. The prosperity brought about by the miracle formula changed the course of history for Israel. Flush with cash and resources, Israel made peace with her neighbors. Free trade and liberal passage allowed all who loved the nation to have access to it. What they did not have access to, however, was the formula. Buck had not even asked the old man to reveal the formula or the complicated security process that protected it from any potential enemy. The very fact that Buck was housed by the military evidenced the importance of security. Maintaining that secret ensured the power and independence of the State of Israel. Never had Israel enjoyed such tranquility. The walled city of Jerusalem was only a symbol now, welcoming everyone who embraced peace. The old guard believed God had rewarded them and compensated them for centuries of persecution. Chaim Rosenzweig was honored throughout the world and revered in his own country. Global leaders sought him out, and he was protected by security systems as complex as those that protected heads of state. As heady as Israel became with newfound glory, the nation's leaders were not stupid. A kidnapped and tortured Rosenzweig could be forced to reveal a secret that would similarly revolutionize any nation in the world. Imagine what the formula might do if modified to work on the vast tundra of Russia. Could regions bloom, though snow-covered most of the year? Was this the key to resurrecting that massive nation following the shattering of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics? Russia had become a great brooding giant with a devastated economy and regressed technology. All the nation had was military might, every spare mark going into weaponry. And the switch from rubles to marks had not been a smooth transition for the struggling nation. Streamlining world finance to three major currencies had taken years, but once the change was made, most were happy with it. All of Europe and Russia dealt exclusively in marks. Asia, Africa, and the Middle East traded in yen. North and South America and Australia dealt in dollars. A move was afoot to go to one global currency, but those nations that had reluctantly switched once were loath to do it again. Frustrated at their inability to profit from Israel's fortune and determined to dominate and occupy the Holy Land, the Russians had launched an attack against Israel in the middle of the night. The assault became known as the Russian Pearl Harbor, and because of his interview with Rosenzweig, Buck Williams was in Haifa when it happened. The Russians sent intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear-equipped MiG fighter bombers into the region. The number of aircraft and warheads made it clear their mission was annihilation. To say the Israelis were caught off guard, Cameron Williams had written, was like saying the Great Wall of China was long. When Israeli radar picked up the Russian planes, they were nearly overhead. Israel's frantic plea for support from her immediate neighbors in the United States was simultaneous with her demand to know the intentions of the invaders of her airspace. By the time Israel and her allies could have mounted anything close to a defense, it was obvious the Russians would have her outnumbered 100-1. They had only moments before the destruction would begin. There would be no more negotiating, no more pleas for a sharing of the wealth with the hordes of the North. If the Russians meant only to intimidate and bully, they would not have filled the skies with missiles. Planes could turn back, but the missiles were armed and targeted. So this was no grandstand play designed to bring Israel to her knees. There was no message for the victims. Receiving no explanation for war machines crossing her borders and descending upon her, Israel was forced to defend herself, knowing full well that the first volley would bring about her virtual disappearance from the face of the earth. With warning sirens screaming and radio and television sending the doomed for what flimsy cover they might find, Israel defended herself for what would surely be the last time in history. The first battery of Israeli surface-to-air missiles hit their marks, and the sky was lit with orange and yellow balls of fire that would certainly do little to slow a Russian offensive for which there could be no defense. Those who knew the odds and what the radar screens foretold interpreted the deafening explosions in the sky as the Russian onslaught. Every military leader who knew what was coming expected to be put out of his misery in seconds when the fusillade reached the ground and covered the nation. From what he heard and saw in the military compound, Buck Williams knew the end was near. There was no escape. But as the night shone like day, and the horrific, deafening explosions continued, nothing on the ground suffered. The building shook and rattled and rumbled, and yet it was not hit. Outside, warplanes slammed to the ground, digging craters and sending burning debris flying. Yet lines of communication stayed open. No other command posts had been hit. No reports of casualties, nothing destroyed yet. Was this some sort of a cruel joke? Sure, the first Israeli missiles had taken out Russian fighters and caused missiles to explode too high to cause more than fire damage on the ground, but what had happened to the rest of the Russian Air Corps? Radar showed they had clearly sent nearly every plane they had, leaving hardly anything in reserve for defense. Thousands of planes swooped down on the tiny country's most populated cities. The roar and the cacophony continued, the explosions so horrifying that veteran military leaders buried their faces and screamed in terror. Buck had always wanted to be near the front lines, but his survival instinct was on full throttle. He knew beyond doubt that he would die, and he found himself thinking the strangest thoughts. Why had he never married? Would there be remnants of his body for his father and brother to identify? Was there a god? Would death be the end? He crouched beneath a console, surprised by the urge to sob. This was not at all what he had expected war to sound like, to look like. He had imagined himself peeking at the action from a safe spot, recording in his mind the drama. Several minutes into the Holocaust, Buck realized he would be no more dead outside than in. He felt no bravado, only uniqueness. He would be the only person in this post who would see and know what killed him. He made his way to a door on rubbery legs. No one seemed to notice or care to warn him. It was as if they had all been sentenced to death. He forced open the door against a furnace blast and had to shield his eyes from the whiteness of the blaze. The sky was afire. He still heard planes over the din and roar of the fire itself, and the occasional exploding missile sent new showers of flame into the air. He stood in stark terror and amazement as the great machines of war plummeted to the earth all over the city, crashing and burning. But they fell between buildings and in deserted streets and fields. Anything atomic and explosive erupted high in the atmosphere, and Buck stood there in the heat, his face blistering and his body pouring sweat. What in the world was happening? Then came chunks of ice and hailstones big as golf balls, forcing Buck to cover his head with his jacket. The earth shook and resounded, throwing him to the ground. Face down in the freezing shards, he felt rain wash over him. Suddenly the only sound was the fire in the sky, and it began to fade as it drifted lower. After 10 minutes of thunderous roaring, the fire dissipated and scattered balls of flame flickered on the ground. The firelight disappeared as quickly as it had come. Stillness settled over the land. As clouds of smoke wafted away on a gentle breeze, the night sky reappeared in its blue blackness, and stars shone peacefully as if nothing had gone awry. Buck turned back to the building, his muddy leather jacket in his fist. The doorknob was still hot, and inside military leaders wept and shuddered. The radio was alive with reports from Israeli pilots. They had not been able to get airborne in time to do anything but watch as the entire Russian air offensive seemed to destroy itself. Miraculously, not one casualty was reported in all of Israel. Otherwise, Buck might have believed some mysterious malfunction had caused missile and plane to destroy each other. But witnesses reported that it had been a firestorm, along with rain and hail and an earthquake, that consumed the entire offensive effort. Had it been a divinely appointed meteor shower? Perhaps. But what accounted for hundreds and thousands of chunks of burning, twisted, molten steel smashing to the ground in Haifa, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Jericho, even Bethlehem, leveling ancient walls but not so much as scratching one living creature? Daylight revealed the carnage and exposed Russia's secret alliance with Middle Eastern nations, primarily Ethiopia and Libya. Among the ruins, the Israelis found combustible material that would serve as fuel and preserve their natural resources for more than 6 years. Special task forces competed with buzzards and vultures for the flesh of the enemy dead, trying to bury them before their bones were picked clean and disease threatened the nation. Buck remembered it vividly, as if it were yesterday. Had he not been there and seen it himself, he would not have believed it, and it took more than he had in him to get any reader of Global Weekly to buy it either. Editors and readers had their own explanations for the phenomenon, but Buck admitted, if only to himself, that he became a believer in God that day. Jewish scholars pointed out passages from the Bible that talked about God destroying Israel's enemies with a firestorm, earthquake, hail, and rain. Buck was stunned when he read Ezekiel 38 and 39 about a great enemy from the north invading Israel with the help of Persia, Libya, and Ethiopia. More stark was that the scriptures foretold of weapons of war used as fire fuel and enemy soldiers eaten by birds or buried in a common grave. Christian friends wanted Buck to take the next step and believe in Christ now that he was so clearly spiritually attuned. He wasn't prepared to go that far, but he was certainly a different person and a different journalist from then on. To him, nothing was beyond belief. Not sure whether he'd follow through with anything overt, Captain Rayford Steele felt an irresistible urge to see Hattie Durham right then. He unstrapped himself and squeezed his first officer's shoulder on the way out of the cockpit. "We're still on auto, Christopher," he said as the younger man roused and straightened his headphones. "I'm gonna make the sun-up stroll." Christopher squinted and licked his lips. "Doesn't look like sun-up to me, Cap." "Probably another hour or two. I'll see if anybody's stirring anyway." "Roger. If they are, tell him Chris says hey." Rayford snorted and nodded. As he opened the cockpit door, Hattie Durham nearly bowled him over. "No need to knock," he said. "I'm coming." The senior flight attendant pulled him into the galleyway, but there was no passion in her touch. Her fingers felt like talons on his forearm, and her body shuddered in the darkness. "Hattie!" She pressed him back against the cooking compartments, her face close to his. Had she not been clearly terrified, he might have enjoyed this and returned her embrace. Her knees buckled as she tried to speak, and her voice came in a whiny squeal. "People are missing," she managed in a whisper, burying her head in his chest. He took her shoulders and tried to push her back, but she fought to stay close. "What do you mean?" She was sobbing now, her body out of control. "A whole bunch of people. Just gone." "Hattie, this is a big plane. They've wandered to the labs, or..." She pulled his head down so she could speak directly into his ear. Despite her weeping, she was plainly fighting to make herself understood. "I've been everywhere. I'm telling you, dozens of people are missing." "Hattie, it's still dark. We'll find..." "I'm not crazy. See for yourself. All over the plane, people have disappeared." "It's a joke. They're hiding, trying to..." "Ray! Their shoes, their socks, their clothes, everything was left behind. These people are gone." Hattie slipped from his grasp and knelt whimpering in the corner. Rayford wanted to comfort her, to enlist her help, or to get Chris to go with him through the plane. More than anything, he wanted to believe the woman was crazy. She knew better than to put him on. It was obvious she really believed people had disappeared. He had been daydreaming in the cockpit. Was he asleep now? He bit his lip hard and winced at the pain. So he was wide awake. He stepped into first class, where an elderly woman sat stunned in the pre-dawn haze, her husband's sweater and trousers in her hands.
"What in the world?" she said. "Harold?"
Rayford scanned the rest of first class. Most passengers were still asleep, including a young man by the window, his laptop computer on the tray table. But indeed, several seats were empty. As Rayford's eyes were accustomed to the low light, he strode quickly to the stairway. He started down, but the woman called to him.
"Sir, my husband!"
Rayford put a finger to his lips and whispered,
"I know. We'll find him. I'll be right back."
What nonsense, he thought as he descended, aware of Hattie right behind him. We'll find him? Hattie grabbed his shoulder and he slowed.
Should I turn on the cabin lights?
No, he whispered. The less people know right now, the better. Rayford wanted to be strong, to have answers, to be an example to his crew, to Hattie. But when he reached the lower level, he knew the rest of the flight would be chaotic. He was as scared as anyone on board. As he scanned the seats, he nearly panicked. He backed into a secluded spot behind the bulkhead and slapped himself hard on the cheek. This was no joke, no trick, no dream. Something was terribly wrong, and there was no place to run. There would be enough confusion and terror without his losing control. Nothing had prepared him for this, and he would be the one everybody would look to. But for what? What was he supposed to do? First one, then another cried out when they realized their seatmates were missing, but that their clothes were still there. They cried, they screamed, they leaped from their seats. Hattie grabbed Rayford from behind and wrapped her hands so tight around his chest that he could hardly breathe.
"Rayford, what is this?"
He pulled her hands apart and turned to face her. "Hattie, listen. I don't know any more than you do, but we've got to calm these people and get on the ground. I'll make some kind of an announcement, and you and your people keep everybody in their seats, okay?" She nodded, but she didn't look okay at all. As he edged past her to hurry back to the cockpit, he heard her scream. So much for calming the passengers, he thought, as he whirled to see her on her knees in the aisle. She lifted a blazer, shirt, and tie still intact. Trousers lay at her feet. Hattie frantically turned the blazer to the low light and read the name tag.
"Tony," she wailed. "Tony's gone."
Rayford snatched the clothes from her and tossed them behind the bulkhead. He lifted Hattie by her elbows and pulled her out of sight. "Hattie, we're hours from touchdown. We can't have a plane load of hysterical people. I'm going to make an announcement, but you have to do your job. Can you?" She nodded, her eyes vacant. He forced her to look at him. "Will you?" he said. She nodded again.
"Rayford, are we going to die?"
"No," he said. "That I'm sure of." But he wasn't sure of anything. How could he know? He'd rather have faced an engine fire or even an uncontrolled dive. A crash into the ocean had to be better than this. How would he keep people calm in such a nightmare? By now, keeping the cabin lights off was doing more harm than good, and he was glad to be able to give Hattie a specific assignment. "I don't know what I'm going to say," he said, "but get the lights on so we can make an accurate record of who's here and who's gone, and then get more of those foreign visitor declaration forms."
"For what?"
"Just do it. Have them ready." Rayford didn't know if he had done the right thing by leaving Hattie in charge of the passengers and crew. As he raced up the stairs, he caught sight of another attendant backing out of a galleyway, screaming. By now, poor Christopher in the cockpit was the only one on the plane unaware of what was happening. Worse, Rayford had told Hattie he didn't know what was happening any more than she did. The terrifying truth was that he knew all too well. Irene had been right. He and most of his passengers had been left behind. Chapter 2. Cameron Williams had roused when the old woman directly in front of him called out to the pilot. The pilot had shushed her, causing her to peek back at Buck. He dragged his fingers through his longish blonde hair and forced a groggy smile. "Trouble, ma'am?"
"It's my Harold," she said.
Buck had helped the old man put his herringbone wool jacket and felt hat in the overhead bin when they boarded. Harold was a short, dapper gentleman in penny loafers, brown slacks, and a tan sweater vest over a shirt and tie. He was balding, and Buck assumed he would want the hat again later when the air conditioning kicked in. "Does he need something?"
"He's gone."
"I'm sorry?"
"He's disappeared."
"Well, I'm sure he slipped off to the washroom while you were sleeping."
"Would you mind checking for me? And take a blanket."
"Ma'am?"
"I'm afraid he's gone off naked. He's a religious person and he'll be terribly embarrassed."
Buck suppressed a smile when he noticed the woman's pained expression. He climbed over the sleeping executive on the aisle, who had far exceeded his limit of free drinks, and leaned in to take a blanket from the old woman. Indeed, Harold's clothes were in a neat pile on his seat, his glasses and hearing aid on top. The pant leg still hung over the edge and led to his shoes and socks. Bizarre, Buck thought. Why so fastidious? He remembered a friend in high school who had a form of epilepsy that occasionally caused him to black out when he seemed perfectly conscious. He might remove his shoes and socks in public or come out of the washroom with his clothes open. "Does your husband have a history of epilepsy?"
"No."
"Sleepwalking?"
"No."
"I'll be right back." The first-class lavs were unoccupied, but as Buck headed for the stairs, he found several other passengers in the aisle.
"Excuse me," he said. "I'm looking for someone."
"Who isn't?" a woman said. Buck pushed his way past several people and found lines to the washrooms in business and economy. The pilot brushed past him without a word, and Buck was soon met by the senior flight attendant.
"Sir, I need you to return to your seat and fasten your seatbelt. I'm looking for..."
"Everybody is looking for someone," she said. "We hope to have some information for you in a few minutes. Now, please..."
She steered him back toward the stairs, then slipped past him and took the steps two at a time. Halfway up the stairs, Buck turned and surveyed the scene. It was the middle of the night, for heaven's sake, and as the cabin lights came on, he shuddered. All over the plane, people were holding up clothes and gasping or shrieking that someone was missing. Somehow, he knew this was no dream, and he felt the same terror he had endured awaiting his death in Israel. What was he going to tell Harold's wife? "You're not the only one. Lots of people left their clothes in their seats." As he hurried back to his seat, his mind searched its memory banks for anything he had ever read, seen, or heard of any technology that could remove people from their clothes and make them disappear from a decidedly secure environment. Whoever did this, were they on the plane? Would they make demands? Would another wave of disappearances be next? Would he become a victim? Where would he find himself? Fear seemed to pervade the cabin as he climbed over his sleeping seatmate again. He stood and leaned over the back of the chair ahead of him. "Apparently many people are missing," he told the old woman. She looked as puzzled and fearful as Buck himself felt. He sat down as the intercom came on and the captain addressed the passengers. After instructing them to return to their assigned seats, the captain explained, "I'm going to ask the flight attendants to check the lavatories and be sure everybody is accounted for. Then I'll ask them to pass out foreign entry cards. If anyone in your party is missing, I would like you to fill out the card in his or her name and list every shred of detail you can think of, from date of birth to description. I'm sure you all realize that we have a very troubling situation. The cards will give us a count of those missing, and I'll have something to give authorities. My first officer, Mr. Smith, will now make a cursory count of empty seats. I will try to contact Pan Continental. I must tell you, however, that our location makes it extremely difficult to communicate with the ground without long delays. Even in this satellite age, we're in a pretty remote area. As soon as I know anything, I'll convey it to you. In the meantime, I appreciate your cooperation and calm." Buck watched as the first officer came rushing from the cockpit, hatless and flushed. He hurried down one aisle and up the other, eyes darting from seat to seat as the flight attendants passed out cards. Buck's seatmate roused, drooling, when an attendant asked if anyone in his party was missing.
Missing? No. And there's nobody in this party but me.
He curled up again and went back to sleep, unaware. The first officer had been gone only a few minutes when Rayford heard his key in the cockpit door and it banged open. Christopher flopped into his chair, ignored the seatbelt, and sat with his head in his hands.
"What's going on, Ray?" he said. "We got us more than 100 people gone with nothing but their clothes left behind."
"That many?"
"Yeah, like it'd be better if it was only 50. How the heck are we gonna explain landing with less passengers than we took off with?"
Rayford shook his head, still working the radio, trying to reach someone, anyone, in Greenland or an island in the middle of nowhere. But they were too remote even to pick up a radio station for news. Finally, he connected with a Concorde several miles away, heading the other direction. He nodded to Christopher to put on his own earphones.
"You got enough fuel to get back to the States?"
"Over,"
the pilot asked Rayford. He looked at Christopher, who nodded and whispered,
"We're halfway."
"I could make Kennedy," Rayford said.
"Forget it," came the reply. "Nothing's landing in New York. Two runways still open in Chicago. That's where we're going."
"We came from Chicago. Can't I put down at Heathrow?"
"Negative. Closed."
"Paris?"
"Man, you've got to get back where you came from. We left Paris an hour ago, got the word what's happening, and we're told to go straight to Chicago."
"What's happening, Concorde?"
"If you don't know, why'd you put out the Mayday?"
"I've got a situation here I don't even want to talk about."
"Hey, friend, it's all over the world, you know."
"Negative. I don't know," Rayford said. "Talk to me."
"You're missing passengers, right?"
"Roger. More than 100.
"Whoa, we lost nearly 50.
"What do you make of it, Concorde?"
"First thing I thought of was spontaneous combustion, but there would have been smoke, residue. These people materially disappeared. Only thing I can compare it to is the old Star Trek shows where people got dematerialized and rematerialized, beamed all over the place."
"I sure wish I could tell my people their loved ones were going to reappear just as quickly and completely as they disappeared," Rayford said.
"That's not the worst of it, Pan Heavy. People everywhere have disappeared. Orly lost air traffic controllers and ground controllers. Some planes have lost flight crews. Where it's daylight, there are car pileups, chaos everywhere. Planes down all over and at every major airport."
"So this was a spontaneous thing?"
"Everywhere at once, just a little under an hour ago."
"I was almost hoping it was something on this plane, some gas, some malfunction."
"That it was selective, you mean? Over?"
Rayford caught the sarcasm.
"I see what you mean, Concorde. Gotta admit, this is somewhere we've never been before. And never wanna be again. I keep telling myself it's a bad dream. A nightmare. Over."
"Roger, but it's not, is it?"
"What are you gonna tell your passengers, Concorde?"
"No clue."
"You? Over?"
"The truth."
"Can't hurt now. But what's the truth? What do we know?"
"Not a blessed thing."
"Good choice of words, Pan Heavy. You know what some people are saying? Over."
"Roger," Rayford said. "Better it's people gone to heaven than some world power doing this with fancy rays.
Word we get is that every country has been affected. See you in Chicago?"
"Roger."
Rayford Steele looked at Christopher, who began changing the settings to turn the monstrous wide body around and get it headed back toward the States. "Ladies and gentlemen," Rayford said over the intercom, "we're not going to be able to land in Europe. We're headed back to Chicago. We're almost exactly halfway to our original destination, so we will not have a fuel problem. I hope this puts your minds at ease somewhat. I will let you know when we're close enough to begin using the telephones. Until I do, you will do yourself a favor by not trying." When the captain had come back on the intercom with the information about returning to the United States, Buck Williams was surprised to hear applause throughout the cabin. Shocked and terrified as everyone was, most were from the States and wanted at least to return to familiarity to sort this thing out. Buck nudged the businessman on his right. "I'm sorry, friend, but you're gonna want to be awake for this." The man peered at Buck with a disgusted look and slurred, "If we're not crashing, don't bother me." When the Pan-Continental 747 was finally within satellite communications range of the United States, Captain Rayford Steele connected with an all-news radio outlet and learned the far-reaching effects of the disappearance of people from every continent. Communication lines were jammed. Medical, technical, and service people were among the missing all over the world. Every civil service agency was on full emergency status, trying to handle the unending tragedies. Rayford remembered the L-Train disaster in Chicago years before, and how the hospitals and fire and police units brought everyone in to work. He could imagine that now, multiplied thousands of times. Even the newscasters' voices were terror-filled, as much as they tried to mask it. Every conceivable explanation was proffered, but overshadowing all such discussion and even coverage of the carnage were the practical aspects. What people wanted from the news was simple information on how to get where they were going and how to contact their loved ones to determine if they were still around. Rayford was instructed to get in a multi-state traffic pattern that would allow him to land at O'Hare at a precise moment. Only two runways were open, and every large plane in the country seemed headed that way. Thousands were dead in plane crashes and car pileups. Emergency crews were trying to clear expressways and runways, all the while grieving over loved ones and co-workers who had disappeared. One report said that so many cabbies had disappeared from the cab corral at O'Hare that volunteers were being brought in to move the cars that had been left running with the former driver's clothes still in the seats. Cars driven by people who spontaneously disappeared had careened out of control, of course. The toughest chore for emergency personnel was to determine who had disappeared, who was killed, and who was injured, and then to communicate that to the survivors. When Rayford was close enough to communicate to the tower at O'Hare, he asked if they would try to connect him by phone to his home. He was laughed off. "Sorry, Captain, but phone lines are so jammed and phone personnel so spotty that the only hope is to get a dial tone and use a phone with a redial button." Rayford filled the passengers in on the extent of the phenomenon and pleaded with them to remain calm. "There is nothing we can do on this plane that will change the situation. My plan is to get you on the ground as quickly as possible in Chicago so you can have access to some answers and, I hope, some help." The in-flight phone embedded in the back of the seat in front of Buck Williams was not assembled with external modular connections the way home phones were. That way, no one could simply snap the unit away from its connecting line and walk off with it. But Buck guessed that inside the phone the connection was standard, and that if he could somehow get in there without damaging the phone, he could connect his computer's modem directly to the line. His own cellular phone was not cooperating at this altitude. In front of him, Harold's wife rocked and whimpered, her face buried in her hands. The executive next to Buck snored. Before drinking himself into oblivion soon after takeoff, he had said something about a major meeting in Scotland. Would he be surprised by the view upon landing? All around Buck, people cried, prayed, and talked. Flight attendants offered snacks and drinks, but few accepted. Having preferred an aisle seat for a little more legroom, Buck was now glad he was partially hidden near the window. He removed from his computer bag a tiny toolkit he had never expected to use and went to work on the phone. Disappointed to find no modular connection even inside the housing, he decided to play amateur electrician. These phone lines always have the same color wires, he decided, so he opened his computer and cut the wire leading to the female connector. Inside the phone, he cut the wire and sliced off the protective rubber coating. Sure enough, the four inner wires from both computer and phone looked identical. In a few minutes, he had spliced them together. Buck tapped out a quick message to his executive editor, Steve Plank, in New York, telling of his destination. "I will bang out all I know, and I'm sure this will be just one of many similar stories. But at least this will be up to the minute, as it happens. Whether it will be of any use, I don't know. The thought hits me, Steve, that you may be among the missing. How would I know? You know my computer address. Let me know you're still with us." He stored the note and set up his modem to send it to New York in the background while he was working on his own writing. At the top of the screen, a status bar flashed every 20 seconds, informing him that the connection to his ramp on the information superhighway was busy. He kept working. The senior flight attendant startled him several pages into his own reflections and feelings. "What in the world are you doing?" she said, leaning in to stare at the mess of wires leading from his laptop to the in-flight phone. "I can't let you do that." He glanced at her name tag. "Listen, beautiful Hattie, are we or are we not looking at the end of the world as we know it?" "Don't patronize me, sir. I can't let you sit here and vandalize airline property." "I'm not vandalizing it. I'm adapting it in an emergency. With this, I can hopefully make a connection where nothing else will work." "I can't let you do it." "Hattie, can I tell you something?" "Only that you're going to put that phone back the way you found it." "I will. Now." "No, I won't do that." "That's the only thing I want to hear." "I understand that, but please listen." The man next to Buck stared at him and then at Hattie. He swore, then used a pillow to cover his right ear, pressing his left against the seat back. Hattie grabbed a computer printout from her pocket and located Buck's name. "Mr. Williams, I expect you to cooperate. I don't want to bother the pilot with this." Buck reached for her hand. She stiffened but didn't pull away. "Can we talk for just a second?" "I'm not going to change my mind, sir. Now, please, I have a plane full of frightened people." "Aren't you one of them?" He was still holding her hand. She pursed her lips and nodded. "Wouldn't you like to make contact with someone? If this works, I can reach people who can make phone calls for you, let your family know you're all right, even get a message back to you. I haven't destroyed anything, and I promise I can put it back the way I found it." "You can?" "I can. And you'd help me?" "Anything. Give me some names and phone numbers. I'll send them in with what I'm trying to upload to New York, and I'll insist that someone make the calls for you and report back to me. I can't guarantee I'll get through, or that if I do, they'll get back to me, but I will try."
"I'd be grateful."
"And can you protect me from other overly zealous flight attendants?" Hattie managed a smile.
"They might all want your help."
"This is a long shot as it is. Just keep everybody away from me and let me keep trying."
"Deal,"
she said, but she looked troubled. "Hattie, you're doing the right thing," he said. "It's okay in a situation like this to think of yourself a little. That's what I'm doing."
"But everybody's in the same boat, sir, and I have responsibilities."
"You have to admit, when people disappear, some rules go out the window." Rayford Steele sat ashen-faced in the cockpit. Half an hour from touchdown in Chicago, he had told the passengers everything he knew. The simultaneous disappearance of millions all over the globe had resulted in chaos far beyond imagination. He complimented everyone on remaining calm and avoiding hysterics, although he had received reports of doctors on board who handed out Valium like candy. Rayford had been forthright, the only way he knew to be. He realized he had told the people more than he might have if he had lost an engine or his hydraulics or even his landing gear. He had been frank with them that those who had not had loved ones disappear might get home to discover that they had been victims of the many tragedies that had ensued. He thought, but didn't say, how grateful he was to have been in the air when this event had taken place. What confusion must await them on the ground. Here, in a literal sense, they were above it all. They had been affected, of course. People were missing from everywhere. But except for the staff shortage caused by the disappearance of three crew members, the passengers didn't suffer the way they might have had they been in traffic, or if he and Christopher had been among those who had disappeared. As he settled into a holding pattern miles from O'Hare, the full impact of the tragedy began to come into view. Flights from all over the country were being rerouted to Chicago. Planes were reorganized based on their fuel supplies. Rayford needed to stay in priority position after flying across the eastern seaboard and then over the Atlantic before turning back. It was not Rayford's practice to communicate with ground control until after he landed, but now the air traffic control tower was recommending it. He was informed that visibility was excellent, despite intermittent smoke from wreckages on the ground, but that landing would be risky and precarious because the two open runways were crowded with jets. They lined either side all the way down the runway. Every gate was full and none were backing out. Every mode of human transport was in use, busing passengers from the ends of the runways back to the terminal. But, Rayford was told, he would likely find that his people, at least most of them, would have to walk all the way. All remaining personnel had been called in to serve, but they were busy directing planes to safe areas. The few buses and vans were reserved for the handicapped, elderly, and flight crews. Rayford passed the word along that his crew would be walking. Passengers reported that they had been unable to get through on the in-flight phones. Hattie Durham told Rayford that one enterprising passenger in first class had somehow hooked up the phone to his computer, and while he composed messages, it was automatically dialing and redialing New York. If a line opened, this would be the guy who got through. By the time the plane began its descent into Chicago, Buck had been able to squeeze onto only one briefly freed up line to his computer service, which prompted him to download his waiting mail. This came just as Hattie announced that all electronic devices must be turned off. With an acumen he didn't realize he possessed, Buck speed-tapped the keys that retrieved and filed all his messages, downloaded them, and backed him out of the link-up in seconds. Just when his machine might have interfered with flight communications, he was offline and would have to wait to search his files for news from friends, co-workers, relatives, anyone. Before her last-minute preparations for landing, Hattie hurried to Buck.
"Anything?"
He shook his head apologetically.
"Thanks for trying," she said,
and she began to weep. He reached for her wrist. "Hattie, we're all going to go home and cry today. But hang in there. Get your passengers off the plane, and you can at least feel good about that."
"Mr. Williams," she sobbed, "you know we lost several old people, but not all of them. And we lost several middle-aged people, but not all of them. And we lost several people your age and my age, but not all of them. We even lost some teenagers."
He stared at her. What was she driving at?
"Sir, we lost every child and baby on this plane."
"How many were there?"
"More than a dozen, but all of them. Not one was left."
The man next to Buck roused and squinted at the late morning sun burning through the window.
"What in blazes are you two talking about?" he said.
"We're about to land in Chicago," Hattie said. "I've got to run."
"Chicago?"
"You don't want to know," Buck said. The man nearly sat in Buck's lap to get a look out the window, his boozy breath enveloping Buck.
"What, are we at war? Riots? What?"
Having just cut through the cloud bank, the plane allowed passengers a view of the Chicago area. Smoke. Fire. Cars off the road and smashed into each other and guardrails. Planes in pieces on the ground. Emergency vehicles, lights flashing, picking their way around the debris. As O'Hare came into view, it was clear no one was going anywhere soon. There were planes as far as the eye could see, some crashed and burning, the others gridlocked in line. People trudged through the grass and between vehicles toward the terminal. The expressways that led to the airport looked like they had during the Great Chicago blizzards, only without the snow. Cranes and wreckers were trying to clear a path through the front of the terminal so cars could get in and out, but that would take hours, if not days. A snake of humanity wended its way slowly out of the great terminal buildings, between the motionless cars and onto the ramps. People walking, 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 looking for a cab or a limo. Buck began plotting how he would beat the new system. Somehow he had to get moving and get out of such a congested area. The problem was, his goal was to get to a worse one. New York. "Ladies and gentlemen," Rayford announced, "I want to thank you again for your cooperation today. We've been asked to put down on the only runway that will take this size plane and then to taxi to an open area about 2 miles from the terminal. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to use our inflatable emergency chutes because we will not be able to hook up to any gateways. If you are unable to walk to the terminal, please stay with the plane and we will send someone back for you." There was no thanking them for choosing Pan Continental. No, "we hope you'll make us your choice next time you need air service." He did remind them to stay seated with their belts fastened until he turned off the seatbelt sign, because privately he knew this would be his most difficult landing in years. He knew he could do it, but it had been a long time since he had to land a plane among other aircraft. Rayford envied whoever it was in first class who had the inside track on communicating by modem. He was desperate to call Irene, Chloe, and Ray Jr. On the other hand, he feared he might never talk to them again. Chapter 3. Hattie Durham and what was left of her cabin crew encouraged passengers to study the safety cards in their seat pockets. Many feared they would be unable to jump and slide down the chutes, especially with their carry-on luggage. They were instructed to remove their shoes and to jump seat first onto the chute. Then crew members would toss them their shoes and bags. They were advised not to wait in the terminal for their checked baggage. That, they were promised, would eventually be delivered to their homes. No guarantees when. Buck Williams gave Hattie his card and got her phone number, "just in case I get through to your people before you do." "You're with Global Weekly?" she said. "I had no idea." "And you were going to send me to my room for tampering with the phone." She appeared to be trying to smile. "Sorry," Buck said. "Not funny. I'll let you go." Always a light traveler, Buck was grateful he had checked no baggage. Never did, not even on international flights. When he opened the bin to pull down his leather bag, he found the old man's hat and jacket still perched atop it. Harold's wife sat staring at Buck, her eyes full, jaw set. "Ma'am," he said quietly, "would you want these?" The grieving woman gratefully gathered in the hat and coat and crushed them against her chest as if she would never let them go. She said something Buck couldn't hear. He asked her to repeat it. "I can't jump out of any airplane," she said. "Stay right here," he said. "They'll send someone for you." "But will I still have to jump and slide down that thing?" "No, ma'am. I'm sure they'll have a lift of some sort." Buck carefully laid his laptop and case in among his clothes. With his bag zipped, he hurried to the front of the line, eager to show others how easy it was. He tossed his shoes down first, watching them bounce and skitter onto the runway. Then he clutched his bag across his chest, took a quick step, and threw his feet out in front of him. A bit enthusiastic, he landed not on his seat, but on his shoulders, which threw his feet over the top of his head. He picked up speed and hit the bottom with his weight shifting forward. The buggy whip's centripetal force slammed his stocking feet to the ground and brought his torso up and over in a somersault that barely missed planting his face on the concrete. At the last instant, Still hanging onto his bag for dear life, he tucked his head under and took the abrasion on the back of his head rather than on his nose. He fought the urge to say, "No problem," but he couldn't keep from rubbing the back of his head, already matted with blood. It wasn't a serious problem, only a nuisance. He quickly retrieved his shoes and began jogging toward the terminal, as much from embarrassment as need. He knew there would be no more hurrying once he hit the terminal. Rayford, Christopher, and Hattie were the last three off the 747. Before disembarking, they had made sure all able-bodied people got down the chutes and that the elderly and infirm were transported by bus. The bus driver insisted that the crew ride with him and the last passengers, but Rayford refused. "I can't see passing my own passengers as they walk to the terminal," he said. "How would that look?" Christopher said, "Suit yourself, Cap. You mind if I take him up on his offer?" Rayford glared at him. "You're serious?" "I don't get paid enough for this." Like this was the airline's fault. "Chris, you don't mean it." "The heck I don't. By the time you get up there, you'll wish you'd ridden too." "I should write you up for this." "Millions of people disappear into thin air, and I should worry about getting written up for riding instead of walking? Later, Steele." Rayford shook his head and turned to Hattie. "Maybe I'll see you up there. If you can get out of the terminal, don't wait for me." "Are you kidding? If you're walking, I'm walking." "You don't need to do that." "After that dressing down you just gave Smith, I'm walking." "He's first officer. We ought to be last off the ship and first to volunteer for emergency duty." "Well, do me a favor and consider me part of your crew, too. Just because I can't fly the thing doesn't mean I don't feel some ownership. And don't treat me like a little woman." "I would never do that. Got your stuff?" Hattie pulled her bag on wheels, and Rayford carried his navigator's leather box. It was a long walk, and several times they waved off offers of rides from units speeding out to pick up the non-ambulatory. Along the way, they passed other passengers from their flight. Many thanked Rayford. He wasn't sure for what. For not panicking, he guessed. But they looked as terrified and shell-shocked as he felt. They shielded their ears from flights screaming in to land. Rayford tried to calculate how long it would be before this runway was shut down, too. He couldn't imagine the other open strip holding many more planes, either. Would some have to try to put down on highways or open fields? And how far away from the big cities would they have to look for open stretches of highway unencumbered by bridges? He shuddered at the thought. All around were ambulances and other emergency vehicles trying to get to ugly wreckage scenes. Finally, in the terminal, Rayford found crowds standing in lines behind banks of phones. Most had angry people waiting, yelling at callers who shrugged and redialed. Airport snack bars and restaurants were already sold out of or low on food, and all newspapers and magazines were gone. In shops where staffers had disappeared, looters walked off with merchandise. Rayford wanted more than anything to sit and talk with someone about what to make of this, but everybody he saw, friend, acquaintance, or stranger, was busy trying to make arrangements. O'Hare was like a massive prison with resources dwindling and gridlock growing. No one slept. Everyone scurried about trying to find some link to the outside world, to contact their families, and to get out of the airport. At the flight center in the bowels of the place, Rayford found much the same thing. Hattie said she would try making her calls from the lounge and would meet him later to see if they could share a ride to the suburbs. He knew they were unlikely to find any rides going anywhere, and he didn't relish walking 20 miles. But all hotels in the area were already full. Finally, a supervisor asked for the attention of the flyers in the underground center. "We have some secure lines, about 5, he said. "Whether you can get through, we don't know, but it's your best chance. They do bypass the normal trunk lines out of here, so you won't be competing with all the payphones in the terminal. Streamline your calls. Also, there are a limited number of helicopter rides available to suburban hospitals and police departments, but naturally you're secondary to medical emergencies. get in line over here for phones and rides to the suburbs. As of right now, we have no word of the cancellation of any flights except for the remainder of today. It's your responsibility to be back here for your next flight or to call in and find out its status. Rayford got in line, beginning to feel the tension of having flown too long and known too little. Worse was the knowledge that he had a better idea than most of what had happened. If he was right, if it were true, he would not be getting an answer when he dialed home. As he stood there, a TV monitor above him broadcast images of the chaos. From around the globe came wailing mothers, stoic families, reports of death and destruction. Dozens of stories included eyewitnesses who had seen loved ones and friends disappear before their eyes. Most shocking to Rayford was a woman in labor about to go into the delivery room who was suddenly barren. Doctors delivered the placenta. Her husband had caught the disappearance of the fetus on tape. As he videotaped her great belly and sweaty face, he asked questions. How did she feel?
How do you think I feel, Earl? Turn that thing off.
What was she hoping for?
That you'll get close enough for me to slug you.
Did she realize that in a few moments they'd be parents?
In about a minute, you're gonna be divorced.
Then came the scream and the dropping of the camera, terrified voices, running nurses, and the doctor. CNN reran the footage in super slow motion, showing the woman going from very pregnant to nearly flat-stomached, as if she had instantaneously delivered. "Now watch with us again," the newsman intoned, "and keep your eyes on the left edge of your screen, where a nurse appears to be reading a printout from the fetal heart monitor. There, see?" The action stopped as the pregnant woman's stomach deflated. "The nurse's uniform seems to still be standing as if an invisible person is wearing it. She's gone. Half a second later, watch." The tape moved ahead and stopped. "The uniform, stockings and all, are in a pile atop her shoes." Local television stations from around the world reported bizarre occurrences, especially in time zones where the event had happened during the day or early evening. CNN showed via satellite the video of a groom disappearing while slipping the ring onto his bride's finger. A funeral home in Australia reported that nearly every mourner disappeared from one memorial service, including the corpse, while at another service at the same time, only a few disappeared and the corpse remained. Morgues also reported corpse disappearances. At a burial, 3 of 6 pallbearers stumbled and dropped a casket when the other 3 disappeared. When they picked up the casket, it too was empty. Rayford was second in line for the phone, but what he saw next on the screen convinced him he would never see his wife again. At a Christian high school soccer game at a missionary headquarters in Indonesia, most of the spectators and all but one of the players disappeared in the middle of play, leaving their shoes and uniforms on the ground. The CNN reporter announced that, in his remorse, the surviving player took his own life. But it was more than remorse, Rayford knew. Of all people, that player, a student at a Christian school, would have known the truth immediately. The rapture had taken place. Jesus Christ had returned for his people, and that boy was not one of them. When Rayford sat at the phone, tears streamed down his face. Someone said, "You have 4 minutes," and he knew that would be more than he needed. His answering machine at home picked up immediately, and he was pierced to hear the cheerful voice of his wife. "Your call is important to us," she said. "Please leave a message after the beep." Rayford punched a few buttons to check for messages. He ran through 3 or 4 mundane ones, then was startled to hear Chloe's voice. "Mom? Dad? Are you there? Have you seen what's going on? Call me as soon as you can. We've lost at least 10 students and 2 profs, and all the married students' kids disappeared. Is Ramey all right? Call me." Well, at least he knew Chloe was still around. All he wanted was to hold her. Rayford redialed and left a message on his own machine. Irene, Ray, if you're there, pick up. If you get this message, I'm at O'Hare and trying to get home. It may take a while if I don't get a copter ride. I sure hope you're there.
Let's go, Cap, someone said. Everybody's got a call to make.
Rayford nodded and quickly dialed his daughter's dorm room at Stanford. He got the irritating message that his call could not be completed as dialed. Rayford gathered his belongings and checked his mail slot. Besides a pile of the usual junk, he found a padded manila envelope from his home address. Irene had taken to mailing him little surprises lately, the result of a marriage book she had been urging him to read. He slipped the envelope into his case and went looking for Hattie Durham. Funny, he had no emotional attraction whatever to Hattie just now, but he felt obligated to be sure she got home. As he stood in a crowd by the elevator, he heard the announcement that a helicopter was available for no more than 8 pilots and would make a run to Mount Prospect, Arlington Heights, and Des Plaines. Rayford hurried to the pad.
Got room for one to Mount Prospect?
Yep.
How about another to Des Plaines?
Maybe if he gets here in about 2 minutes.
It's not a he, she's a flight attendant.
Pilots only, sorry.
What if you have room?
Well, maybe, but I don't see her.
I'll have her paged.
They're not paging anyone.
Give me a second. Don't leave without me.
The chopper pilot looked at his watch.
3 minutes, he said. I'm leaving at 1.
Rayford left his bag on the ground, hoping it would hold the helicopter pilot in case he was a little late. He charged up the stairs and into the corridor. Finding Hattie would be impossible. He grabbed a courtesy phone.
I'm sorry, we're unable to page anyone just now.
This is an emergency, and I'm a pan-continental captain.
What is it?
Have Hattie Durham meet her party at K-17.
I'll try.
Do it.
Rayford stood on tiptoe to see Hattie coming, yet still somehow she surprised him.
I was fourth in line for the phone in the lounge, she said, appearing at his side. Got a better deal?
Got us a helicopter ride if we hurry, he said.
As they skipped down the stairs, she said,
Wasn't it awful about Chris?
What about him?
You really don't know?
Rayford wanted to stop and tell her to quit making him work so hard. That frustrated him about people her age. They enjoyed a volleying conversation game. He liked to get to the point.
Just tell me, he said, sounding more exasperated than he intended.
As they burst through the door and onto the tarmac, the chopper blades whipped their hair and deafened them. Rayford's bag had already been put on board, and only one seat remained. The pilot pointed at Hattie and shook his head. Rayford grabbed her elbow and pulled her aboard as he climbed in.
Only way she's not coming is if you can't handle the weight.
What do you weigh, doll?
The pilot said.
115.
I can handle the weight, he told Rayford. But if she's not buckled in, I'm not responsible.
Let's go, Rayford shouted.
He buckled himself in and Hattie sat in his lap. He wrapped his arms around her waist and clasped his wrists together. He thought how ironic it was that he had been dreaming of this for weeks, and now there was no joy, no excitement in it, nothing sensual whatever. He was miserable. Glad to be able to help her out, but miserable. Hattie looked embarrassed and uncomfortable, and Rayford noticed she took a sheepish peek at the other 7 pilots in the copter. None seemed to return her gaze. This disaster was still too fresh, and there were too many unknowns. Rayford thought he heard or lip-read one of them saying, Christopher Smith, but there was no way he could hear